Hello, I'm Claire White, and joining me is Kyle Willoughby.
Hello, friends.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We are here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today, we are talking about The Defenders.
The Defenders. What do they do?
The Defenders is the final miniseries in the original five Marvel shows ordered by Netflix. It brings together Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and the Iron Fist as they work to save a maybe collapsing New York City from sinister forces. It was released on August 18th of this year and is the sixth collaboration between Marvel and Netflix. Its showrunner is Marco Ramirez, and it stars Charlie Cox, Kristen Ritter, Mike Coulter, Finn Jones, and Sigourney Weaver, among others. Kyle will be talking about the history of defending.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about how defending started. It started in the NFL with, that's a bad joke. Yeah, I'm going to talk about the Defenders, where they started. And I also want to have a brief preamble before that about team-ups in comics in general.
So. Ooh, I like that. Ooh. And I'll be talking about the production on The Defenders and also Netflix and Marvel and Disney and Marvel.
Yeah, which there's some
actually,
drama.
Actually, Disney and Netflix, too. There's so much.
There's some drama going on right there.
Yeah,
there right now.
And I love juicy TV drama. So I'll just tease you with that. And Kyle, why don't you talk to us about The Defenders?
All right, so I'm going to start with superhero team-ups in general. Team-ups and crossovers have been a known income generator trick in comics since 1952 when Batman and Superman first crossed over together.
When they shared a bed.
When they shared a bed on a cruise ship. that's a different story. The idea of superhero teams is sort of what started Marvel Comics to begin with. In 1960, DC had come up with the Justice League, which was the super team of Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, Green Lantern, and Aquaman.
Oh, DC did it first.
To great popularity. Yeah, they did. And the Justice League was very popular and very successful.
Which we will probably be talking about come November.
Come November when
Justice
that movie
League
comes
movie.
Out. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So Stan Lee wanted to make his own super team, and his idea was the Fantastic Four, whose success spawned the Marvel Universe, because the Fantastic Four was very successful when it came out. After the Fantastic Four came out, other successful superhero teams created by Stan Lee came out, such as the X-Men, along with multiple individual heroes, characters like Iron Man, Thor, the Hulk, Doctor Strange, and Marvel's most successful hero, Spider-Man. Now, we know that a lot of those individual characters would eventually form their own super team, the Avengers, who are maybe right now the most currently popular superhero team, but it didn't actually start that way. The Avengers, who were Thor, Iron Man, Hulk, Ant-Man, and Wasp, first assembled in 1963. And these characters at that time were Marvel's B-list heroes, coming together for kind of a B-list team. They were hoping that it would help boost sales of all of them combined. Marvel's most popular characters, the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man, were conspicuously absent from any Avengers shenanigans.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they kind of had them separated out. And Captain America would later join the Avengers after, I believe, issue 4. And the idea was fairly haphazard, with Stan Lee never quite figuring out how to write well for them, and Jack Kirby apparently just having fun with the art, with these big page spreads and these long fight scenes. He just wanted to draw a bunch of goofy stuff. It wasn't until 1967 when Roy Thomas had taken over writing and John Buscema, the art, that Avengers really found its footing and became kind of the more like the Avengers we know of today.
Right, and became more popular?
Yeah. But why are we talking about the Avengers? This is a Defenders episode.
You know, I genuinely was thinking that.
Well, the Avengers' creation and eventual success with these B-list heroes led to Roy Thomas, the guy who helped make the Avengers good, creating a new super team in 1971, which was the Defenders.
Mm.
Yay! And now that less than enthusiastic yay is sort of accurate for the forming of the Defenders, honestly.
I didn't mean to do that.
No, I mean, I did it too, because the Defenders forming was not much of a triumphant gathering, honestly. It was more of a desperate attempt from an author to tie up loose story ends. So this is kind of an interesting story. You see, Roy Thomas, who had made the Avengers helped make the Avengers popular, was writing a bunch of comics in the late 60s and early 70s. He was writing the Avengers, he was writing the Hulk, he was writing Namor the Submariner, which, for those of you who don't know, is Marvel's Aquaman equivalent, and he was writing Doctor Strange, and he loved writing Doctor Strange. But in 1970, his Doctor Strange series was canceled before he could finish the story arc of that comic.
Was it not popular?
It wasn't selling enough, yeah. Mm. So what is a desperate writer to do? Well, when you're still the author of a bunch of other titles in a shared universe, maybe you start trying to use your other titles to finish your Doctor Strange story.
You know, I had read that Doctor Strange been part of the Defenders or worked with them.
Yeah.
I didn't realize this is why.
He was the Nick Fury of the Defenders. Roy Thomas's Doctor Strange plot started to spill over into his Namor the Submariner series and then into his Hulk series. And finally, in December of 1971, the Defenders appeared. The comic was called Marvel Feature Number 1, and the Defenders team consisted of the Hulk, Doctor Strange, and Namor the Submariner.
The Hulk was on the Defenders?
It's, if you think about it, power level-wise, it's a pretty overpowered team, this original one, between the Hulk and Doctor Strange. And the next iteration of the Defenders throws in the Silver Surfer, who is one of the most powerful beings in the Marvel Universe.
Wow, because in this TV show, they're street level.
It's like, oh, we're street level heroes, yeah.
They deal with this stuff that the Avengers can't be bothered with.
No, and well, in the first Defenders, they ended up fighting Dormammu, was the ultimate villain at the end.
And who's Dormammu?
Dormammu was, if you listen to our Doctor Strange episode, Dormammu is the kind of ultimate villain of Doctor Strange.
Oh, yeah. He's pretty strong.
He's very strong, yeah. And with the Defenders, they apparently spent as much time fighting amongst each other as they did fighting the villains. And that was something that would become a hallmark for the team as it went on, that they would always kind of fight with each other.
And that's not something that happens in the Avengers?
I mean, Marvel is known for kind of the melodrama amongst its heroes, but the Avengers, where they did have some infighting, they always had a leader, they always had a mission statement, they had a headquarters, they were organized. That's another hallmark of the Defenders. They were kind of a non-team. They had no leader. They had no headquarters. There was iterations where there was somewhat of a leader. Angel from X-Men led the Defenders briefly in the late 70s, and he financed a headquarters. But they never really came together as a real team like the Avengers were. Another thing about the Defenders is heroes would come in to the Defenders for an issue or two and then leave. But they would still be considered Defenders. If they appeared in Defenders, they were considered Defenders. So
almost once a Defender, always a Defender.
Once a Defender, always a Defender, even if you're only there for one issue. Mark Buxton, in a Den of Geek article entitled The Defenders, A Comic Book History of Marvel's Weirdest Team, called the Defenders the Airbnb of superhero teams. Because anyone who showed up for one issue would just be a Defender for life, even if they were barely there. And almost everyone showed up. The Silver Surfer's been in Defenders. Hercules has been in the Defenders. The Thing has been in the Defenders. Howard the Duck is a Defender. And so is Dracula.
Oh. So how do we have our four? Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, Daredevil, Iron Fist.
Well, it's interesting about those four Defenders because only three of them have been Defenders and only two of them have ever met or have ever been in a Defenders comic at the same time. So Daredevil and Luke Cage were in one issue together in 1975. The Iron Fist was in the Defenders for one issue in 1978, and Jessica Jones became a Defender for the first time this past August in Brian Michael Bendis' relaunch of the team to coincide with a Netflix show. So she's never been a Defender until just a month ago. So I want to talk a bit about some of the history of our current Defenders, since that's kind of, you know, that's what the show's about. We have an episode on Daredevil where you can find out about the fun-loving, swashbuckling character created in 1964. And he was fun-loving and swashbuckling until Frank Miller got his tragedy-loving, depressing mitts on him in 1980. And then it's a whole other thing. He's an alcoholic. Karen Page, one of his love interests, is a heroin-addicted porn star. It's a rough time for Daredevil.
I know. If you think
Frank
the Daredevil
Miller
show
got...
is dark, go to the comic.
Oh, Frank Miller. We also have an episode all about Luke Cage, who is a bulletproof, super strong African-American superhero who was born out of the popular wave of blaxploitation films of the 70s, and it was Marvel's attempt to really cash in on those films' popularity. So those are episodes you can check out if you want to hear more about them. They are very good. I just re-listened to them in preparation for this.
I re-listened to them too.
And I was like, oh yeah, we're good. We're the best.
And we're so humble.
And then, you know, our current iteration of the Defenders, there's Iron Fist, or Danny Rand, who we originally planned to do an episode on, but decided against it when we realized we would have to watch roughly 13 hours of a not so great television show.
Yeah, that was a hard pass.
So we did backpedal a bit on Iron Fist, but I would maybe if they do a second season, we can do one on him in the future.
They have a new showrunner.
Do they? I bet they do. So Iron Fist first appeared in 1974 as a young man who had been stranded in the Far East after his wealthy parents were murdered by an evil business partner. He was eventually taken in by monks in the mystical village of Kun Lun and taught martial arts, and he becomes the wielder of the powerful Iron Fist, which is a mystical force that allows him to summon and focus his chi into his fist. And he can do, in the Netflix show, you really only see him punching things, but in the comic, he can do a lot with that Iron Fist chi. Like, he can heal himself and help other people, and he can do...
That sounds so interesting.
Yeah.
It's crazy that they're only doing the fist.
Yeah, I don't quite get it either. And that the combat was a little lackluster in that, too. It's a little curious.
We'll talk about it later.
Yeah. Iron Fist also, in the way that Luke Cage was kind of born out of the popularized blaxploitation films like Shaft, Iron Fist was born out of Kung Fu getting really popular in the United States. And Marvel's like, oh, this Kung Fu is pretty popular. We should make a Kung Fu character. And, you know, maybe we can get some new fans. And then there is Miss Jessica Jones. Jessica Jones is a much more recent creation, and she came out of the mind of Brian Michael Bendis, the same guy who was penning the current New Defenders. Bendis had grown up reading those aforementioned depressing Frank Miller Daredevil comics, along with the character-driven work of Chris Claremont, who wrote for Luke Cage and Iron Fist, and he also famously wrote for the X-Men. And Jessica Jones was somewhat of a marriage of those two styles. He kind of took Miller's tragedy, just depressing aspects that Frank Miller would put into his characters, such as Daredevil, who we mentioned, and Chris Claremont's, you know, flair for the melodrama and kind of character-driven stories, and made this really cool new character with a very unique voice. She debuted in 2001 in her own series called Alias, which ran from 2001 to 2004, and was then continued in Pulse, which was also written by Bendis. And both of these comics were huge, huge influences on Netflix's Jessica Jones show. Alias was one of the titles that actually launched Marvel's R-rated Max prints. And the Jessica Jones series deals with addiction, sexual assault, and rape. It's very serious, it's very heavy, but it's supposedly very well written. I haven't gotten the chance to read Alias yet, but I really, really want to now.
And the TV show Alias has nothing to do with Jessica
Jones. The TV
Jones.
Show Alias has nothing to do with Jessica Jones. That was with what's-her-face?
Jennifer Gardner. I think that's what made her a star. Yeah. And
Jessica Jones has super strength and can sort of fly.
Oh.
It's hinted that if she kind of got her act together, she would be able to fly, but she... kind of can't. She's a very interesting character, and I want to talk more about her backstory because in the comic Alias, it's something that's, as you're reading it, that it's kind of revealed as you go. So it brushes into spoiler territory if you're curious about finding more about Jessica Jones, which I definitely am because I really liked her in Defenders. So that is my segment on Defenders and superhero team-ups.
Cool. Very cool, Kyle.
Thank you, Claire. I'm actually really excited to see or hear about the showrunners on this because I want to know who they were and like what they did before.
Okay. Well, the showrunner is Marco Ramirez, and in TV, he has worked on Sons of Anarchy, Orange is the New Black, Fear the Walking Dead, to name a few. But he actually started off in playwriting, which he still does. He graduated from Juilliard for playwriting, the real deal. And most recently, his play The Royal about Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion, was off-Broadway at Lincoln Center.
Oh, I feel like I actually heard of that play.
I did, too. And you know, funny story, when I was researching him, they kept on... this article in the Miami Herald kept on coming up about this playwright, Marco Ramirez. And I was like, oh, I need to find out about his history. And this playwright just keeps on getting in the way. This other playwright, Marco Ramirez. And I kept on ignoring it for the longest time until I finally resorted to going to his IMDb profile. And I was like, he's a playwright. Okay, let's read this Miami Herald article. But anyway, that's my bias. I'm like, he can't be a playwright and write for Netflix.
Impossible.
Right. Well, as far as his work with Netflix and Marvel goes, he worked as a writer on the first season of Daredevil. And then he took over as a showrunner on Daredevil season two with Doug Petrie after Steven DeKnight left. Yeah. And he was the one who basically helmed most of Daredevil season one.
He did. I think Steven DeKnight stepped up to producer for season two.
Right. He was stayed on as a consultant. Yeah. And I just think this is funny. Do you know what he left to go do?
Steven DeKnight?
Mm-hmm.
No.
It is still nerdy. Some might consider it better, and some might consider it a step down.
What did he do?
Transformers.
Oh, really?
I'm sure the money was much better.
You know what? He's also supposed to do the second Pacific Rim film, which I'm kind of excited about.
I guess Transformers might help with
that. Yeah, might help with that.
Writing robots,
yeah.
That sort of thing.
Exactly.
So he and Petrie learned that they had the Defenders showrunner gig when production was closing on Daredevil season two. And Ramirez keeps on saying it felt like that was his audition.
Season two was.
Of Daredevil. Because, you know, they're weaving together three major characters plus a bunch of smaller characters that are still important to the story, making it work. We both enjoyed Daredevil season two.
It might be my favorite of the Netflix Marvel shows.
I think it's more your wheelhouse than mine, but yeah. I can appreciate that it was very well done. And some of the best fight choreography I think I've ever seen.
It's awesome.
Amazing. Now, here are some of the obstacles he was going up against when writing The Defenders. When he got the gig, Luke Cage and Iron Fist hadn't been completed. And actually, I don't think Iron Fist had even started filming. And they hadn't cast most of it either. So he and Doug Petrie got to watch the first few episodes of Luke Cage early to get a feel for the character. And they were also finding out who was being cast in major roles as they were writing the script.
So
Wing, who's one of the major characters in Iron Fist, and she's a pretty major character in The Defenders, was one of those characters where someone ran up to their office and was like, "We have our Colleen." And then they were actually watching audition tapes from like the new character so they would get a feel for how the actor was going to play them. Now, he says it took a couple of months to figure out how to bring all the characters together, and that Marvel didn't give them specifics in terms of what needed to happen to the Defenders. Marvel had some very broad strokes worked out. Jeff Loeb, who is the head of Marvel TV, knew what he wanted the Defenders to be in the end, but, you know, he didn't really say, like, this is how you have to get there. But with these broad strokes that they kind of put out in the very beginning when they first started this arc of like four superheroes and then one accumulation of all of them. A lot had changed about it. Shows ended up a little bit differently than what they originally thought. And they also said actors defined characters differently than what they had originally thought. And it's not bad things. It's just it didn't quite line up the way they originally thought it was going to be. They also had to work on the villain because they needed to find something big enough to bring all the characters together, but small enough so that what I call the big guns don't need to get called in.
Thor doesn't burst through a building and like look at Sigourney Weaver and be like, "You're coming with me."
Oh my gosh, that would be the most terrifying thing for that character. It would be over.
The villains from Defenders wouldn't know what to do with themselves.
And that is a very fine line to walk. I can see how that would be a challenge. He says that, like the Daredevil series, they took cues from shows like The Wire and The Shield instead of other superhero movies. They wanted it to be, you know, street level, multiple point of views from different characters. Real,
yeah.
I guess, is what they were going for. As real as the Marvel Universe can get. And then he talked about using these other characters because he is the Daredevil showrunner. And then he's taking all these other characters from other shows and putting them into its own show. He kind of refers to using them as leasing a car, a really nice car. It's like, "I'm going to borrow this. I won't mess up your beautiful Ferrari, and I'm going to give it back all in one piece."
Do not scratch that Ferrari.
And he did interact with other showrunners, just minimally, but to make sure he wasn't completely messing up their voices. And he said, ideally with this show, he's carrying over everybody's story and kind of making half series for them. So what he said, like, for example, this is Luke Cage season 1.5, Daredevil season 2.5. This is like the halfway mark on the way to their next season. And he was very conscious that the show didn't become a Daredevil show or shortchange any of the other characters, since that's what he was used to writing for.
We should bookmark this comment because I want to come back to it in opinions.
Okay, we'll do that. I also want to say that his co-showrunner, Doug Petrie, left right before the Defenders went into production. So he helped write the script, but then he left. And I looked into why he left and I couldn't find anything on it. I didn't dig super far because there's a point where you're like, okay.
Just point of diminishing returns, yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't matter. So now I'm going to move from the showrunners and the production to the big guns. And by the big guns, I don't mean the Thor. I mean Disney, which I would say is arguably just as powerful as Thor.
Disney might be more powerful than Thor.
Right. So I'm going to talk about Disney streaming content because that's a big thing right now. In 2016, after its exclusivity contract with Starz, the streaming service Starz, ended, Disney made a deal with Netflix where the Netflix would have exclusive streaming rights for Disney content in the U.S. And so basically anything Disney that's streaming has to be on Netflix, which I didn't realize until I read this. Now, this August, Disney announced that it intends to launch its own streaming service in 2019 for this is where you have to go to this site and pay for the site like an HBO Go, Hulu, Netflix subscription if you want to stream any Disney material. And that would end its deal with Netflix. Now, it sounds kind of like a ripoff, right? Disney getting greedy and asking for more money.
It does.
But they actually toned it back a little bit because they originally were thinking of having just a Star Wars channel. And just a Marvel channel. And then they scrapped that idea, decided they would put everything under one streaming service. So it'll be Pixar, it'll be Marvel, it'll be Star Wars, it'll be their animation, all under one channel. Their Disney Channel shows, too.
Yeah, they have Indiana Jones now, too, so we could start seeing that.
They get more and more powerful. Yeah. And now, also, this is nothing strange. Everyone is trying to cash in on the Netflix, Hulu streaming services money, and people are stopping watching. I talk so well. People have kind of stopped subscribing to cable.
Yeah.
They only view content through streaming services as a rule. Apparently, speak about ballsy, DC is intending to launch its own superhero-specific streaming site.
Really? Is it animated or live action?
Probably animation will be on there too.
I see. DC animated movies and shows are still pretty solid.
Right, but is it $10 a month solid?
Depends on how much you love DC superheroes. I don't know.
I think it's pretty ballsy. I know people love the live action shows. I don't watch them.
You mean the animated shows?
No, The Flash.
Oh, yeah, The Flash and
Arrow.
Supergirl and Arrow.
People love them.
I always forget about
them. See, that was the first that was the first thing I thought of, and then I thought of the animation. But it still sounds really ballsy to me.
Yeah, that is.
And then if you're going to put your movies on there, you could either make it just for kids or just for adults. But the movies are so dark that I don't think you could market this DC channel just for kids, even if you just, put animation on there.
Yeah, you couldn't. Well, some of the animation's really dark, too.
Right. That's a whole nother podcast. We'll probably discuss it at another time when DC launches a streaming service.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Kyle and I live in the United States, and we are pretty lucky because when something is released, be it TV show, movie, video game, book, we basically get to see it as soon as it comes out. But apparently, the rest of the world, it doesn't work this way, even though we're all still so connected. So while this Disney streaming service might not be very popular here, apparently this will actually give access to people all around the world to the content at the same time it's released for us. So like in the UK, people there can't watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. until 3 months after it's released in the U.S. So this will give everyone access to shows at the same time, which is nice.
Yeah, and I wonder if they're trying to tap into the big China market, which is huge in Hollywood
now.
Oh, I'm
sure they are.
Yeah,
I'm positive that's part of it. Well, the big question from all of this is what's going to happen to the Marvel Netflix shows? Are we going to have to pay another channel to be able to watch Jessica Jones and Luke Cage and Daredevil and Iron Fist take on bad guys?
I hope not.
Well, Kyle, take a deep breath. We're not going to have to.
Oh, that's great news, Claire. Thank you. I want to hug you, but I'll knock the mic and it'll be a problem.
But we'll hug afterwards. Well, Netflix produces these shows. And by produce, I mean they create and pay for them. So they're not getting those to Disney.
good.
And also, if you think about it, they're pretty dark and brutal.
Yeah, that, and you were just saying about DC, how they would have trouble reconciling between adult content and kid content. Disney would have the same problem.
Right. But I think these shows are on the really... on the darkest side of the Disney material.
Because sure.
You can put Marvel and Star Wars and
together,
that's a solid PG-13. But
Jessica Jones in there?
Rated R. Daredevil? Hard R. And like the first season of Daredevil, a guy gets decapitated because his head is being slammed into a car door over and over and over again.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Oh, I didn't. I never will. I saw that. So in this vein, let's talk about the Marvel-Netflix partnership. And did it work out? Is it working out? Apparently, in 2013, when they announced the deal, they committed to all five shows. They committed to Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist, and The Defenders.
That's ballsy that they didn't do like a test the water show.
Right. It's kind of Netflix's style where they completely commit to a show no matter what. Like, unlike, say, network TV, where they'll do a pilot and they'll watch the pilot.
Yeah, see who likes it.
And then they'll commit to so many shows and then they'll test the water, see how the ratings are. Netflix just balls to the wall.
We're doing this all the way.
Right. And Jeff Loeb, who's the head of Marvel TV, was like, it was the most brave, crazy thing done in television. And I don't know if I completely agree with it, because I think committing to Game of Thrones was a brave, crazy thing. But on the other hand, like, that was a huge commitment.
Yeah.
And you didn't know if it was going to pay off. Now, the thing is, this was 2013, and the Avengers had just come out, and that had been very popular.
Marvel didn't have a lot to lose by doing that.
That's a lot of money. And Daredevil, the first season of Daredevil, could have been horrible. And then where do you go from there?
They were riding that Avengers money. They could ride that for years and years. They could spend it all in Disney World. It wouldn't matter.
Oh, that would be an interesting segment, like how much connection there is between Marvel TV and Marvel Studios.
Yeah.
Because I think they're actually pretty separate.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story. And it was Netflix's money.
That's true.
Netflix produced shows. Well, so looking at it now. Right now, they're working on Jessica Jones Season 2, Luke Cage Season 2. The Punisher, who is a spinoff character from Daredevil Season 2, is getting a show in November. Also, this August, they announced that they're planning on shooting Daredevil Season 3 and Iron Fist Season 2, which they bumped up. And so Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, Daredevil, and Iron Fist are all probably set to be released in 2018. Netflix is always cagey about when exactly they're going to be releasing shows. This could be a whole lot of podcasts.
Yeah,
episodes.
That'd be a lot of podcast episodes of 2018
for us. But regardless, this is a huge change for how Netflix started managing Marvel content. In 2015, when Daredevil was first coming out, Netflix said that they ideally would like to release a new season every 6 months.
What?
Right.
Whoa.
But I think this speaks volumes to how popular this content is. And this is also coming at a time when Netflix is canceling a lot of shows. When we did a Stranger Things episode around this time last year, we talked about how Netflix doesn't cancel shows. That was their policy at the time, that they felt that every show had an audience, and even if it didn't have good reviews, it would find a niche audience somewhere. Well, recently, Netflix has started axing, especially a lot of their more expensive shows. And they have said that shows for niche audiences are great. However, really expensive shows for niche audiences
not so great.
Aren't something that they can keep doing.
Yeah.
So they canceled Sense8. They canceled The Get Down. Those are two really big ones. Bloodline. I guess they just didn't have a big enough audience for them. Now, these Marvel shows can't be cheap.
No.
There's a ton of characters, there's a ton of special effects, multiple locations around New York City, and yet they're doubling down on them. So Netflix doesn't release stats for how popular their shows are and, you know, what is the most watched. But I did see an article on Business Insider, which I will link to on the Facebook page. And basically, by analyzing ratings data, social media chatter, blogging, and illegal pirating, they'll try and rank the most popular shows on Netflix at the time. This article came out in August, and out of the 10 most popular shows, Iron Fist and The Defenders were both on there. So Iron Fist, even though it was really poorly received by critics and by fans, is still being watched. And it came out in the spring of this year.
Yeah,
it didn't even come out recently.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, so these shows are making Netflix money, or giving them subscribers, I guess.
Which makes, in turn, makes them money, yeah. That is fascinating. And I was curious as to see who the showrunners on Defenders were as well, which I think moves us into opinions.
Yeah, what did you think, Kyle?
I thought it was not so great. I did enjoy it, you know, at times, but I was also a little disappointed.
Yeah, so I had super low expectations going in because I'd read so many articles that were like, Defenders is a slog. Defenders is not good.
Okay.
And so I was ready to grit it out for 8 episodes for the podcast.
Yeah.
And then about halfway through, I was like, this isn't horrible. I think I'm kind of enjoying it. And then at the end, they lost me. it was really disappointing the way it ended because I feel like it had some great moments.
Yeah, I hadn't read any reviews for it, so maybe that colored my interpretation of the show. But I liked the beginning, and I sort of liked the middle. But you're right, the end was kind of a huge bummer.
And the dialogue was some of the worst dialogue I have watched on a TV show in a while. Now, granted, because of streaming services, I cherry pick what I watch.
Yeah, this is true.
By a lot. So I'm not watching network sitcoms of, you know, dubious quality.
Yeah.
But I was shocked, especially because I thought Daredevil season 2 was pretty good.
That's why I was surprised to hear that Marco Ramirez was the showrunner on this, because I thought Daredevil season 2 was awesome as well. And I said to bookmark this when you said he was worried about not making it a Daredevil show. He should have made it a Daredevil show. It should have been the Defenders, but mostly focused on Daredevil, because that seems to be who he writes the best. And if he's the showrunner, maybe it should, because I feel like it was kind of focused on Iron Fist, kind of focused on Daredevil, and it was...
Yeah, those were the two main story plots revolved around them.
Yeah, and it lost some because it was spread thin, in my opinion, between those two characters, where if they would have picked one, preferably Daredevil, because Ramirez wrote for Daredevil, and I think the Daredevil seasons were better, but yeah, that's interesting.
Did you watch Iron Fist?
I watched 3 episodes of Iron Fist, and I didn't hate it. Like, I know a lot of people really didn't like it, but it didn't grab me. I do plan to go back and, I guess, help the Iron Fist numbers for September in Netflix, because I do want to finish it.
I think Iron Fist was number 9 on their top 10
shows.
Okay,
well, maybe it'll bump down to number 10 now.
But, yeah, it was, because I hadn't seen any of the Iron Fist season. I heard it was bad. We nixed it for the podcast, and I kind of had this wave of relief wash over me. Like, I don't have to do it. Because I don't love the Netflix shows in the same way you and our producer James love them.
Yeah.
And I feel like we all get to cherry pick our topics, and sometimes it's more focused on you, sometimes it's more focused on me. And a bad Marvel Netflix show was just something I wasn't interested in watching.
It's a lot. It's 13 hours, roughly, of investment. It's 13 episodes.
Right.
It's about an hour long. It is a lot.
So coming into it, even coming into The Defenders, though, I feel like I didn't need to watch Iron Fist. Like, I got what the plot was. And I don't know if they did that on purpose or not. But I think it would have been harder coming into this not knowing the Daredevil plots.
Oh,
there are
definitely
a lot of integral pieces of the Daredevil story that are in this show. It would be harder, I think.
Yeah. Claire, who was your favorite of the Defenders characters in the show?
I probably like Elektra the best, played by Elodie Young. I think I like that character. I don't think she was particularly well written in the show. Also, Scott Glenn, who plays Stick, who is basically Daredevil's blind mentor, I thought he did some of the best acting in the show. I believed him and that ridiculous dialogue he had to say every time he opened his mouth.
Scott Glenn is great. For those of you who don't know, he was in Hunt for the Red October, and he was in my favorite Western, Silverado. So he's really good. But yeah, he plays Stick. He was great.
What was your favorite part?
Jessica Jones. I feel like. First of all, the Defenders didn't have great chemistry amongst each other. I feel like, or maybe it was part of the way they were written. I don't know. But Jessica Jones, I felt every time she was in a scene with other Defender characters, she made it okay. She made it better. She created chemistry between them where there was none when it was just them alone. Like,
well, she also had all the funny lines.
She was a lot more fun. She was kind of the comic relief of a very very serious.
Right. No, and I did enjoy Kristen Ritter's performance and Jessica Jones. I just, when they were all together, I was never very excited about it. Or, you know, you start off being excited because they're together, and then it just gets weird.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the fights. Because the reason you tune in to watch Daredevil is some badass fight choreography.
Some insane fight choreography.
Or not Daredevil, the Defenders. And in Daredevil, you got that fight choreography.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just so bad. For this is not even a spoiler, but for anyone thinking about watching the Defenders for the fighting, prepare to be disappointed.
It's a little disappointing. There's a cool, and this is seen in the trailers, it's in the third episode, but there's a scene where they're fighting in a boardroom in like an office building, and I thought that was a lot of fun. But other than that,
that was the best one, for sure.
The fight scenes were a
peaks at episode 3.
Yeah, Philip Silvera was the one who did the fight choreography for Daredevil season 1 and season 2.
Oh, and it was so good. I mean, in Daredevil season 2, you're
not
so
Defenders.
Yeah, you're so scared of the bad guys. Like, yeah. They could really do harm, and the fights are super intense, super intricate. I mean, they have ninjas scaling a hospital in Daredevil season 2, and it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And here, it's just, like, they're ninjas, but they're, like, Joe Schmo ninjas, I guess,
yeah.
That, like, are not fighting at the same degree that they were fighting in Daredevil.
It seems like the hand's ninja quality has gone down in recent years.
Right, the hand being
the evil,
the bad guy.
Yeah.
And I also don't think they quite worked out what the limits to each of the characters' powers were. It was never defined, and all of a sudden Jessica Jones is fighting ninjas no problem, even though she keeps on saying that she
doesn't
all of a sudden
karate.
Is surrounded by ninjas and doesn't know karate. Yeah. And I just thought that could have been handled so much better. And they could have found creative ways that she was helping everyone out. You know what I mean? While really defining, like, this is what she does. Maybe she could have accidentally flown, and all of a sudden, that's something that comes up. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah. I agree with you with the power levels. I think Jessica Jones, when you're right, she was fighting ninjas, but when she lands a punch, that should be the only punch she needs to land. She's super strong.
Right.
And that was not really the case. She was just
also,
like,
how strong is she
people.
Compared to Luke Cage? Which was also never quite explained.
Yeah. And in the comics, Luke Cage is much stronger. My producer and I, James, we talked about this because we're curious. We looked it up, and Luke Cage is much stronger.
Isn't he like Thor level strong? Not Thor,
no,
Hulk
not,
level strong.
He's not Hulk level strong, but he's extremely, extremely strong. Where Jessica Jones can lift maybe like 8 tons. Luke Cage can lift 40-plus tons, according to this website that James and I looked up. So,
yeah, they never made that clear.
No, it was not clear at all.
And also, how good is Danny Rand at Kung Fu? Especially compared to Daredevil. That was never explained.
Yeah.
And if you look at what they're basing this off, the Avengers, they make it very clear in every Avengers movie exactly what everyone's powers and capabilities are.
Yeah.
I feel like they do, they're not perfect, but they do a fairly good job at, like, this is what this person can do. This is what this person can do. In a fight, this is how this person with these, like, limited powers could be very useful.
Well, you know what, though? This does kind of harken back to the Defenders being somewhat of a haphazard, bizarre team put together by Marvel in the comics.
So they're just staying on brand?
So they're just staying on brand for not having a leader, for not really doing teamwork very well.
In a mosh pot with a bunch of ninjas.
And then just a cave with a bunch of ninjas.
But I was going to say, this was also very disappointing. What the Netflix shows have gotten right is villains. And this, again, goes back to the Avengers and the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is that the villains are normally very weak in the Marvel movies. But I feel like in the Marvel TV shows, they've had some amazing villains. And maybe it's because they have 13 episodes to really flesh them out. But Kingpin in Daredevil is great.
Great villain.
I mean, the Punisher is kind of a villain in Daredevil,
also
but
great.
Even that is great. And the Purple Man in Jessica Jones is terrifying.
Maybe
I had
best.
Nightmares terrifying after watching Jessica Jones.
Maybe the best Marvel villain, in my opinion.
And even Luke Cage. I didn't think Luke Cage was as strong of his series, but the villains were at least fleshed out.
Luke Cage had half a good villain in Mahershala Ali.
Right.
That was great.
And they get great actors to play them. I mean, Marvel Cinematic Universe does too. But I feel like Marvel Cinematic Universe villains are more like this great name.
Yeah.
Like, look who we got to be the villain. Whereas in the TV series, they actually are going after character actors who are doing really intense work.
Yeah.
On fleshing out these characters.
I agree. And when I saw Sigourney Weaver was going to be the main villain for Defenders, like, I was super excited because I love her to death.
And I think Sigourney Weaver is a great actress, but I think it was the same thing where they got this big name, got excited about it, and then didn't give her much to do.
Yeah, they really didn't. The I don't think this is much of a spoiler, but the motivation of the villains is a little lackluster and letdowny, I thought. I mean, what do you think about that?
Oh, yeah. It just could have been fleshed out better. Wasn't fleshed out better. Could have been really cool. I mean, it's ninjas.
Yeah. It's a secret society.
Right. And it could have been so interesting and so cool. And maybe they needed more time.
Yeah.
But they got to pick how many episodes they wanted to do.
That's true.
It was going to be a mini series, but they could make it as many as they wanted.
As I was watching Defenders, I was getting flashback to this most recent Game of Thrones season, which I'm like, no spoilers, but that season moved very, very fast. And had 7 episodes. And in Defenders, there's 8 episodes. And I was like, wow, they're really moving this pretty quick. I thought maybe they were going to try and set it up a bit better. But
right. They didn't even have to make it that big, in my opinion. I think they could have built the Defenders slowly.
Yeah.
Maybe done the miniseries where, like, they're just starting to meet and get together. And it's a more minor incident that brings them together.
Yeah. I agree.
Do you recommend this, Kyle?
I do, actually. I do.
For all of our talk.
For all of our talk and all of our railing against it, I really love the Netflix Marvel show universe, and I love Jessica Jones so much, and I love Daredevil so much, and I think Mike Coulter is a good Luke Cage, and I want to love an Iron Fist.
Which might happen.
Which might happen, yeah, because they're getting a new showrunner for season 2, because season 1 was so poorly received.
Oh, apparently that showrunner went off to do other things.
Okay.
It was a mutual
breakup.
Yeah.
So there were parts of Defenders I liked. And it's only 8 episodes, and I just love that universe so much. Of course, I would say watch it, and I'm going to be watching the next Netflix shows, including Iron Fist, which I still have to catch up on.
Punisher, which is coming out in November.
Super jazzed about that.
Yeah.
What about you, Claire? What do you say about the Defenders?
Unless you're a fan of this universe, don't watch it. Jessica Jones, I can say, yeah, watch that show. It holds up on its own. And even Daredevil, if you want to see some of the most awesome fight choreography and some great character work, watch Daredevil. But this is a slog. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Claire White.
And I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. And we would really appreciate it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps us out. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Along With Claire, that's C-L-A-I-R-E.
I can be found on Twitter at Klex303, that's K-L-E-X-303.
And you can find our producer James at James Foey Jr., that's James F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R on Twitter. You can learn more about the Defenders and Disney and Netflix stats and teams of superheroes.
And super teams.
On our Facebook page, we'll be posting some of the articles that we use for the research. Our producer, who likes to think that he is a ninja, is James Foey.
But he's an evil ninja.
Our logo is done by Patty Hyland, and she is actually a ninja. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who...
he flunked out of ninja school.
Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you in 2 weeks.